You are listening to A Novel Podcast, in-depth discussions of literature from all genres and generations. I'm your host, Russell. I'm joined by my wife, Sarah, and our good friends, Julie and Lauren. Today we're discussing All the Light We Cannot See, a novel written by American author Anthony Doerr, published by Scribner on May 6, 2014. It was the winner of the 2015 Pulitzer Prize for Fiction and the 2015 Andrew Carnegie Medal for Excellence in Fiction. I'd like to start by saying that typically I'm not much of a fan of literature that doesn't have some kind of a science fiction or supernatural element, but despite that, I did thoroughly enjoy this book. I found that the symbolism was excellent. I really got deep into what he was trying to say in a story, and I also thought that the historics of the book didn't really interfere with the characters, and it wasn't too heavy-handed in terms of historical fiction, so I did thoroughly enjoy it. Lauren, what did you think?
When I got it at the library, the librarian was like, oh, this is really great. This is a really good one. You'll like it. And I was like, oh, damn, that's probably not a good thing. Because usually when you tell me, oh, you're going to like this, I'm not going to like it. I was very neutral on it. The characters really didn't make me feel one way or the other. Like, I wasn't exactly rooting for anyone. So I guess kind of neutral, but I also kind of rushed through it too, so.
Sarah, did you have an opinion?
I liked the characters for the most part, the two mains, and I thought that the secondary characters were also interesting. I liked that everyone sort of had a part to play in the story, but I guess after hearing you say you weren't really rooting for anyone, I kind of agree. I think the format of the novel, the way it flashed back and forward, made it difficult to, like, I knew everyone was going to live up to a certain point.
Yeah.
So I found that distracting.
I did too. Like, I remember halfway through it, I was like, oh, wait, this was from years ago. Wait. So it made me feel like
overall impression of the book.
I liked it a lot. I liked the book a lot. Okay. I really enjoyed the characters, and I also thought about them later, which I always feel like that's a really good sign in a book, if you keep thinking about it when you're done, not just after you close the cover. And I kind of thought about them more and more and kind of wondered, you know, what would they be doing, you know, kind of post.
I agree with you. That's true.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I had, and we can kind of talk about this later, I'm curious to see, I really, really, really disliked one section of the book, and it didn't completely ruin it for me, but it was the section kind of towards the end where the Russians come in, it was the rape scene, was completely unnecessary, it was really quick and did not really do anything with the story. Like, she was such a secondary character, but I just thought it was a completely gratuitous, unnecessary. Other than that, though, I enjoyed it a lot.
From a literary standpoint, why might Anthony Doerr have thrown that scene in there?
You know, I can't figure it out, because I feel like this is, it's a Pulitzer Prize winning novel, so you would think, I felt like it was like, well, you know what, I need a dramatic, I felt like it was gratuitous, like, I need a dramatic rape scene because that makes it more intense, but you wouldn't think that an author of this stature would put it in there for that purpose, so I feel like they're, you know, what did you guys think?
I honestly thought that it was, since Werner was dead, and obviously Marie-Laure wasn't involved in this part, and they were bringing Yuta in at the end, I thought it was just their way of pulling her in from a secondary to a more primary.
Mm. Yeah. The whole time. That's what I thought was puzzling.
Yeah.
Like, was it just for
shock
value?
Do you feel like it was maybe just to juxtapose? Like, everything was going well for the most part?
Yes.
Possibly.
So this is just to show the flip side of the coin. You're thinking that maybe everyone's going to make it out relatively unscathed.
Yeah.
And then that group doesn't.
But it did seem it was very skippable.
It wasn't in line.
Really following Jaja's story at that point.
Right.
No. And that's what I said. Like, I thought maybe they were just because at the end, since she does meet up with Marie Laure to focus on her, like, I just kind of felt like it was okay. We need to pull her in to make her the focus at this point because Werner is dead. So this is how we do it.
Yeah, maybe.
Maybe just, hey, remember she exists. And exactly. She existed during the war also. Because really all we saw from her were a few letters that went back and forth.
Because he kind of forgot about her as he was getting more immersed in what he was doing. Because it seemed like she was sort of like the reason. She was keeping everything, like, you know, from childhood. And, you know, he was going into this world like where there was some brutality. And he was kind of pulling away from her.
I feel like he as a character needed to forget about her in order to do what he was doing at that point in time.
Yeah, I totally agree with that.
And about what he was doing at that point in time, the question I wanted to raise is it right to do something only because everyone else is doing it? Which is a direct quote from the book. So what do you think about that?
I was kind of, in the case that he was in, had he not done what everyone else was doing, he could have ended up suffering a lot of the same fate that Frederick did. Frederick was beaten within an inch of his life. He was brain damaged. So it's very possible that had he not followed the herd, he could have, you know, ended up with that same fate. And we kind of see that at the end when he breaks away and he tries to save Marie Laure and he ends up dying himself. So
did he really need to die? What was the significance of his death? What was the cause? What was the purpose?
That I don't really remember. I remember that he died. I remember they were in the house. Another soldier was in there. And he had gotten her out. I think it was probably the whole significance was just the fact that, again, you know, it was the Nazi regime and they were kind of, they were heartless. They were cold. I mean, and they were following orders as well. So they dispatched of her, you know, they dispatched of him quickly and, you know, he was no longer of use to them.
True. That leads to what I consider the most significant point of the book, which is where Marie insists that Werner take her through the gate so that she can get rid of the stone, and then he goes back to get it, or you think. What he chooses to do with the stone, I find that to be the most significant point of the book. Julie, what did you think?
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, I got to think about that for a minute.
The decision that Werner makes to save the house and dispose of the stone, I found that to be the most significant point of the entire book. Sarah, did you have an opinion about that?
Well, why do you think that was... I have questions about your opinion. Why do you feel like that was the purpose behind the entire book?
The miniature house, the artistry that Marie's father put into that miniature house had more value than this stone, which could have brought, and I can't remember the character's name, but could have restored the Nazi general that was in Marie's uncle's house while it was only Marie and her.
Yeah.
Could have restored him to life. That was his crusade. And found more important in the house that Marie's father had built than in the stone itself. And decided that he didn't want to see the house destroyed, but then held on to the house long enough to get it in Werner's sister's hands, but then just decided to take a walk out onto the landmine.
I thought that I felt like Werner's death was almost symbolic of the pointless and futile task of the Nazi army. I mean, they felt, of course, I guess Werner proposed a juxtaposition between Hitler's goal and the actual kids that were in the army at that point in time. So he, saw beauty and value in this house and this artistry and wanted to save a memory of Marie. But then in the end, he was saved. He lived. He's in a camp. It might not be the best existence, but it's possibly better than the existence he's had recently since becoming a Nazi, but he chooses to take a walk in a field and blows up, and that's the end. And it just seems so pointless and sad, and he's made it through so much, and he saved Marie and saved this house, and that was the end. That was how he went. And it just seemed bleak.
Maybe that was like the whole point with the war. I mean, kind of after that, like after he, you know, saw that, maybe there was kind of no turning back from that. Maybe like once.
I think so.
Yeah. Like there was just no turning back. So it was never going to be the same. Like he was never going to be able to go home and just be Warner again. He was always going to be Warner the Nazis. So there was no way that he could break away from that and just end it.
So do you think they left it a bit ambiguous in the book, whether it was a specific suicide or he was just taking a walk? I guess it implied that if he hadn't stepped on a landmine, they would have probably shot him.
So yeah, that's what I got from it.
A specific choice. He knows he's never going to be able to go back to childhood, to Jeddah. It's never going to be the same again. So he's choosing to end it on his terms.
That's what I got from it.
And would you consider Werner to be a brave character?
I personally think so.
I think that the amount of disgust that he had for himself and what he did, and I think that it was just too much for him to bear. That he was that person, and how do you go and live life after that? You know,
I felt that Werner throughout his entire life had only ever done what he was told, what was expected of him. And even in the very end, when he does decide to break rank and save Marie Lord's life, he doesn't even know why he's doing it. So the question I have is, where did this courage in the end come from? And I personally believe it had to have come from that dead girl that was haunting him.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. I remember that. That was so... Yeah, that was interesting. One question I'm just going to sidebar for a second is, I was confused over... I felt like it was, I'll use Sarah's word, ambiguous, as to what exactly, I didn't realize that the stone was completely gone, and that, like, he didn't know the value of that stone, right? So why he would have, or the historical thing behind it,
right.
So why would he have gotten rid of it?
And it was Von Rumpel's crusade to find the stone. It was Von Rumpel who believed that the stone was going to save his life. And he was threatening Marie Laure's life to get at the stone. So was it that Werner saw the stone as tainted, as a threat to all that he felt pure, whereas the house itself was everything that he believed was pure?
That's what I kind of got from it.
Yeah. That's right. He knew that was the source of the why they were in the predicament.
Right. And, I mean, in that case, directly, what was causing directly the destruction of what he saw as pure and innocent and
right.
Really a direct thing to his child. I mean, that was the radio broadcast that her, that was a direct link to his happy,
right.
His good time.
Yeah, I really enjoyed how all of those elements came back to that, and that's why they had all of these, this spider web of stories that, you know, it's like, you know, when they all come together, you're like, oh, I knew they were going to, but thank goodness they finally did. But I agree with what, I think what Sarah
right?
said, I agree with what Sarah said earlier, which was, I had to go back a lot in this book and look at dates. And I'd be, you know, because it'd be like a new chapter and it's a new date and it's a new character. And you're like, oh boy, how did I leave off on this last one? I found
that very
distracting.
Which timeline are they in?
Right. Yeah.
So speaking directly about that, did you find the book a little bit difficult to read? Because as a parent and a working parent with a busy schedule, I generally appreciate shorter chapters, a book that I can pick up and read a couple chapters and put it down. But I found like that was a bit of a hindrance in this case because of the back and forth time shifting and the each chapter focusing on a different character, but being so short. I mean, the longest chapter was, what, 4 or 5 pages long?
You know what? That's such an interesting point, Sarah. That's so true because we do get distracted so often and we, you know, and it's not like I can't sit down and read for as long as I used to be able to do. And so you come back to it a lot. Yeah, that was definitely a challenge for me.
Lauren, you have a little different perspective.
Yeah.
You don't have the kids running around. Did you find the same thing when you were reading?
I did. Actually, when I had, right before I had started, like when I had first gotten it from the library, I ended up back to day to day, and I was reading Game of Thrones at the same time, and I'm like, okay, I could probably read this in Game of Thrones at the same time. I think I was reading Gatsby, and then one of the people in my department had to take a leave of absence, so they were like, oh, so by the way, you're going to be teaching 11th grade again, and in between, like, I had to kind of stop because then I had to like reread Gatsby for real because I was having to teach it and I was having to do research paper with that too. And it was just like, I would get home and I would try to read this and I'm like, I don't have the brain power. I don't have the energy to concentrate on this like at all.
Okay. I felt like I ran into that also. Did you feel the same way, Ross?
Not at all, but I was listening to it on audio.
That might have helped.
It seems to flow a little bit better that way.
Oh,
that's the way I read most of my books.
Mm-hmm. It's a little hard to get into because of the way it was bouncing back and forth.
Yeah.
And then Russ and I talked about this because I got to the end of the book, towards the end of the book. And I specifically remember Julie coming over to your towards the end of the book. And you said, yeah, I just have to do it. And I got towards the end and I said, I just have to do it. Like, I just have to finish this and kind of rip the Band-Aid off and get it over. And I said to Russ, why is everyone struggling to end this book? I feel like you get, you know, 20 or 30 pages from the end, and everyone I talked to just kind of stalled out there when they were reading it.
Yeah.
Do you feel like the stalling, the hesitation to finish, and do you feel that? But do you feel like it's reflective of the writing style or reflective of, we all know how historically, we all know how this story would end in real life, and you just don't want to see that happen to these characters.
Maybe a little column A, a little column B. Like I said, I was very, very neutral on the characters. Like, I was glad Marie lived, but at the same time, it was kind of like if they would have killed her, I probably wouldn't have been horribly upset by it. It wouldn't have affected me in a great way. So the fact that I just feel like it was the way it was written was kind of leading to the delays and like the distractions and the difficulties trying to get into it, trying to finish it and all the stalling.
What about you, Julie?
Well, I will say this, when I was talking about this earlier, but I actually left family and friends at a really fun weekend to finish the book. So I must have stalled maybe 3/4 of the way through or something like that, because I was really, the last, I would say, you know, quarter of it or whatever, I was in it, man. I was, you know, avoiding.
Did you say it was when Volkmer, like, got to the house? Was that when it got more intense and wanted to get through it?
That's a really good question. I wish I remember where I was when I told you. I was like, man, I just got to power through this, because I definitely changed my tune, because I was really,
right.
I would have to go back through it and think about that. That's a great question. Cause I really, like I said, the rape scene threw me off. But other than that, I was really definitely wanting to know.
Well, that would have been about 3/4 of the way through. Maybe that was it.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this. There's a scene at the very end during that, pretty much everything that happens after 1955 is very different than the rest of the book. But there is one scene where Marie is with her grandson, and her grandson is playing a video game, and the video game is a multiplayer game. He's playing it against somebody who's not even there. That brings in the theme of radio waves. It's radio that brought everyone together. It's radio that kept Werner and I can't remember his colleague's name, but he kept them alive when all they had to drink was paint water. It was radio again, thing, but radio was very significant throughout the whole book. And here she is, when radio was such a far reach from her when she was 16, and here she is, 75, and radio is just everywhere. Her grandson has it in her hands. What did you guys think of that?
You know what? That's so interesting. I didn't make that connection at all, but I can't imagine. Well, I kind of can now. We were actually talking with Annika earlier about we didn't even have cell phones when we were little, which blew her mind. But just the concept of her probably watching how easy it is for her grandson and thinking, you know, this is just a thing for you, but this was a lifeblood to me and my brother when we were young.
Well, how about this? She's watching her grandson with that thing in your hand saying, well, when I was your age, that thing would have gotten me killed.
Right.
I suppose that's true. Do you think that, Bree, because she was a pretty altruistic and wholesome character, do you think that she's just thankful that she lives in the world she currently lives in, almost as a result of what happened in Nazi Germany and Nazi Europe in general?
As in, she's very happy that he's able to play that game, that radio wave is free and public?
I think that she's very appreciative of that. She didn't have that, and the fact that he's able to do something like that when it could have cost her her life, I think that she just, you know, that she's able to realize and be grateful that he's able to do things like that without the threat of being killed.
But then at the same time, right at the height of the story and the climax of the story, Bree chose to use radio waves to reach out. Her own safety be damned, really. Well, here you have Nazi Germany eliminating any weakness that they see. And they would perceive this little blind girl as a major weakling to be eliminated, no questions asked. But here she is standing up to the entire Nazi army in the attic of a house alone. She can't see. She doesn't know whether it's day or night. She doesn't have food. She doesn't have water. Her death is very much imminent, but
I thought that was a big part of it. The fact that she was isolated, I think the fact that her isolation, because it was so present, the fact that's why she reached out. Stephen King once put this, I think it was in Salem's Lot, there's a worse word than murder, and it's alone. So I think that it kind of, that would really apply to that situation, because she was alone, and the radio connected her with others, and she would rather be connected with someone, have someone there, have some sort of support, rather than be alone, and nobody would even know that she was dead.
And only her mind.
That it was a one-way connection. She had no way of knowing anyone was even hearing what she was saying.
Yeah, it was. I'm pretty sure that it was Salem's Lot.
I think that when you only have your own mind to talk to all day long, all night long, you know, you think about just obsessing with just your own thoughts and going back and forth and back and forth, and, you know, it's maddening. I can't imagine how just maddening. I'm just, you know, I would just think of her up in that attic, just.
And
it's kind of inevitable that it's going to happen, that she's going to do it because she has to, or like that she'll go mad.
Even a one-way connection, she could still kind of put in her mind that, like, even imagine that somebody else out there was listening, and it would be more of a comfort than being completely alone like she was.
Right. I think, now kind of coattailing on what you were talking about earlier, Russ, with the radio waves, one of the opening quotes for the book was from Joseph Goebbels, who was Hitler's, he was pretty high up. I don't know if it was second in command, but I did read his Wikipedia page before I started the book. But the quote is, "It would not have been possible for us to take power or to use it in we have without the radio." So then,
wow.
Yeah, I think after you finish the book, that quote holds a lot more significance, which happens in most books, I believe. You know, you don't understand the quote at the beginning until you've finished. But I think in light of what you were talking about, and in light of the way Marie acted at the end of the book, that's really significant. So as the Nazis were using the radio to spread darkness, she was holding a little light.
So that leads into the question I want to propose to everybody. What exactly is all the light you cannot see?
I think that it is in a world for horror like they were in, which was obviously that entire time in the world. You know, there's just kind of the age old thing. And this may be too simplistic of a way to look at it. You know, there's still a little light. There's still a little radio wave out there that, you know, people can hold on to for hope and for survival.
Okay, what you were kind of saying with that, and then sort of what we were talking about before, or like with the one-way radio, even though no one else can see it, no one else knows it's happening, no one else can hear it, it's still happening, so everybody else can't see or hear. It's still there, so I thought that was kind of significant with the title.
Oh, you know what?
To kind of
nerd out on that, you're right, because radio waves are light. So I didn't even think about that.
So I think it could sort of have a dual meaning. And yeah, that like Maria is spreading this light that you cannot see with her radio broadcast. But then would you also say that the light in Werner would be light that you can't see, that spark of innocence that the Nazi party completely thought had been eliminated from him? Yeah, snuffed out. He's 100%. He's their go-to guy. He's rooting out these radio waves and finding the people making broadcasts and helping to eliminate them. But he still has a light in there, and that saved me and saved us and, you know, resulted in the semi-happy ending that we had.
Werner, it was never, like, it was never completely snuffed out, even though he was kind of following orders the whole time. Because, again, he was the only one of them that went to go see Frederick. He was the only one who tried to help Marie. Let's say her name right.
How do you think that Frederick ties into that light, though? I've been trying to puzzle him in, and I feel like I'm struggling.
Because he had too much light. His character, I have like a physical reaction even when you guys talk to him, because I thought his character was just so beautiful, and he was obviously the bravest one. He made the choice that nobody else was willing to make, which was no, just say no, you know, which I think it's interesting to think about. Would I choose survival, or, you know, what would I choose in that situation? Survival or, you know, being a human?
Falling in line.
Right.
And I saw it, like, also, like, I'm tying back into the light. The fact that he was, I mean, he suffered a traumatic brain injury. He kind of reverted back to an innocent childhood character. Like, he didn't go forward. He was stunted. Not even at the age that he was injured at. He was stunted at an age before that.
Right. So he was taken back to that childhood light. I kind of feel like that was the light. That childhood innocence, that spark. And Julie, I agree with you that Frederick is like what you hope for in the next generation and your children. That pure, bright innocence. And, you know, that sort of reaction and the ability to look past the bad and focus on birds in his case, but you know, something light and not fall in line.
Right.
Do the difficult thing. Well, what's the elementary school motivational quote poster? What's right isn't always easy, and what's easy isn't always right.
Harry Potter.
That was up in like 1987 in my own.
Harry Potter rehashed it, no doubt, but where's a literary podcast, not an educational podcast.
Oh, right.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting because how can you not fall in love with a character that is so soft hearted but strong willed, obviously, that you know, he's the only one who says no.
Well, one of the lines that really stuck out to me was Frederick talking to Werner when I think it was the first time that they went back to Frederick's apartment. And Werner said something along the lines of something to this Nazi school. And Frederick said, "What I want doesn't matter."
Mm.
And that really struck me. And it seemed almost counter to what his character was. So was Frederick, do you think, just falling in line with the goals of his family and his parents? Which of course led to
I think that he wasn't really in a position where he could refuse.
Right.
I mean, yeah, he was exactly. Like, he was young enough that he was still under the dominion of his parents, so it was kind of like, well, this is what you're doing. Okay, I guess this is what I have to do. I want to do it, but I guess I have
doesn't
to.
Matter.
Yeah, I think he said, you know, you can go because you're my parents, but once I'm there, you know,
you can't make me do a good
choice.
Job. Yeah.
Right. By the way, I'm such I just Googled. So visible light is a form of electromagnetic radiation, as are radio waves, infrared radiation, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So go back to the physics of it.
which is
radio, you know, radio waves are light, and I think that it's a beautiful
literally
metaphor.
Light we cannot see.
Yeah, exactly. So I think it's a beautiful metaphor that I didn't even think about when I was reading the book. Thanks for bringing.
Sorry, Julie, I'm a bigger nerd than you.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a heck of a contest.
Okay, so
it is.
Well, I really appreciate everybody's good thoughts, and I know we could talk about this for hours, so I hate to wrap it up, but I am going to ask that we wrap it up here, so I'm going to ask everybody to input three things. Number one, if there's anything at all that you want to say about this book that hasn't already been said. Number two, I'd like to know, what was your favorite scene from this book? And then number three, what else have you been reading? What else would you like to share outside of this book? So let's start with Lauren. Lauren, what were your final thoughts?
Favorite scene, though, I really like the... Just anything that lady that was Whitfrey's uncle, Madame, I don't remember what her last name was, but I really liked her. The fact that she was with all the other ladies and they were looking for those little ways to trip up the Nazis. I really, really liked her.
Resistance. Oh, I loved that. I love that you brought her up.
She was like kind of she was kind of like my bright light in the book. Like I said, everybody else, it was just kind of like, but I really, really liked her. She really struck a chord with me.
Okay, Julie. So same question. Any final thoughts? And then what was your favorite scene?
I loved some of the beginning scenes with her father and Marie Laure's father. And when he was building building the neighborhood, and they were exploring that, and just the detail behind those descriptions, I feel like I can see that, those miniatures and all of that. And I think it's the most beautiful concept that he would think to himself, you know, this is how I'm going to help my daughter survive in the world. Of that.
Yeah, that's really interesting.
Okay, so I'm going to lead that into... I'm going to leave that in for Sarah. What was your final thought and favorite scene?
So, favorite scene is hard to say, but I read a lot. I like to read. And one of the lines that jumped out, so much so that I wrote it down towards the end, was on page 465. And it was from Werner. And it was the scene where he's finally confronting the general in Marie Laure's house. And they're coming face to face. And I think that was really interesting climax, the way it was approached. That really it was built up for a quarter of the book, back and forth, what's going to happen here. And he says in those final minutes when the confrontation's about to happen, "All your life you wait, and then it finally comes. Are you ready?" And that was the thought that went through his head right before I think he shot the general or lunged at him. I should have probably made reference to exactly what happened. But that line, when I read it in the book, really made me stop and pause. And I think it gave me chills and just, I had to stop reading and think about that for a while. Because how true is that? All your life you wait and you're planning. And then when it comes, are you going to strike? Are you going to make the right decision? are you going to realize that this is the instant when you need to make that right decision?
So Werner nailed it. He got it right. He saved innocence and what was pure. In his choice to save the stone or the house, he saved the house. The other note I had was that I went through this entire book without becoming overly emotional or shedding a tear. And then I got to Jutta receiving the duffel from Volkemar towards the end of the book. And it really touched me because you read horrible things. Well, you read horrible things in this book. What happened to Frederick, rapes, murders. But it was the beauty of Jutta receiving that voice from the past, the voice of her brother, that completely touched me. Volkemar is an ex-Nazi already living his own life, and he's willing to take his own time to set something right. I thought it was a beautiful symbol. We just talked about the darkness and how in here we have another example of the light seeping through. The chances of this duffel ever reaching Jutta are just so small at this point. It's been across the ocean through dozens of different hands. And I think her receiving it and these people making that effort to get it into the right spot make the event all the more meaningful. At this point in the story, Jutta's afraid to even make eye contact with people because she's afraid of being shunned because she's German. But here's this little bit of light shining through, a reminder of her brother and a reminder of times that were better. People making the effort and making connections to get this little duffel bag to where it needs to be seem to be a testament to the good that Werner left behind. I think the beauty of this was some of the light that we have left when we're at the end of the book, after all the darkness.
I totally agree. Well said, Sarah.
So I'll wrap it up with my two cents. At some point in time, and I wrote this down, Werner was asked, "Why do these things at all, if not to become what you want to become? You still believe your life is your own." So if it was Frederick who said that to him, does that mean that Frederick has completely given up and has given in to the Nazi regime? Does that mean that Werner does have somewhere inside of him a little bit of courage, and it takes that ghost to bring it out of him? But what I really wanted to say was my favorite scene in the book. It's a scene where Marie is about to open up her last can of food. She's in the house all by herself, and she is just about ready to open up that last can of food when she hears somebody come in the front door, and she has no idea who it is. And this scene is my favorite scene because, like I say, I really like supernatural, I like horror, and that is a very suspenseful scene because you're in the house all by yourself, you can't see, and someone's coming, and you don't know if they're coming for you or if they're coming to help you. It's a very tense scene. It reminded me a lot of the scene in The Village where the blind girl has to go out into the woods all by herself, and she's being hunted by this thing, and you don't know if this thing, I mean, you don't know what it is. It could be in her imagination. The two scenes really reminded me a lot of each other, and I thoroughly enjoyed both of them. The only criticism I have is of the narrator. And like I say, I was listening to this on audio. The narrator really blew that line. You know, he would think he would put a lot of suspense into it, as in, and just as she's about to bring the knife down on the can, she hears the door open. And he put it in such a happy-go-lucky kind of a term, you heard, and just as she was about to open the can, she heard the door open. And I don't want to be too harsh on him. He did a pretty good job, Zach Appleman. He did a pretty good job throughout most of the book. It was just that one scene and a few other little things here and there that kind of irked me. I hate to say it, but Scott Brick's the best. Zach just doesn't hold a candle to Scott Brick. All right, well, thank you guys for sharing that about all the light we cannot see. I'd like to take a minute now to do one thing. We're going to go around the table, and I'm going to ask for three things. Number one, book recommendations for next podcast. Number two, what have you been reading that's awesome outside of All the Light We Cannot See? And number three, anything else you want to throw in? Lauren, we'll start with you.
Since I got back into teaching English 11, the last two things that I had to kind of read content-wise were Great Gatsby and Tuesdays with Maury. I love both Tuesdays with Maury especially. I've also just been outside of that. I've been reading the Game of Thrones series. I just started Dancing. Wasn't too impressed with Feast for Crows, but I really liked the first three. and just kind of intermittently rereading Stephen King out there. Recommendations for the next one, definitely something Stephen King. I would love to like tackle that. He's my favorite. He's coming to Pittsburgh. I want to go see him.
Okay, Stephen King-wise, which would you prefer? Something newer like Lisi's Story or Dumicki, or a classic like It or Salem's Lot?
Classic. It or Salem's Lot would be tremendous. Salem's Lot, I have It somewhere, but John kind of destroyed the cover of my copy, so like I've been trying to get a nicer copy. I think the newest thing, I did read Finders Keepers, but it was a while ago, so if it was something newer, I would probably have to reread.
Have you read Lisi's Story?
I think I got it, and then for finished it, I wasn't sure what the circumstances were. I think the newest, like I said, I read Mr. Mercedes, I read Finders Keepers, I started Revival and never finished it. Before that, it was, I think, as recent as The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon, and I hated that, and that kind of turned, I couldn't stand
that
it.
That book was great!
My mom liked it. I couldn't stand it. It kind of turned me off from the new Stephen King.
You're just not a Red Sox fan? What's the deal?
I don't know. I just got bored. It was kind of like, I don't really want to read about a girl in the woods eating berries and having diarrhea all the time.
No? Why not?
Yeah, it sounds great.
I don't know. Just
the greatness in that book was in the symbolism. There's no doubt there.
I felt like I could read that Tucker Max book. Because usually I'm not reading, right? Like, I'm reading Stephen King for, like, the content. I'm not a lot of times reading it for the symbolism, but
you're right. Tucker Max is the one I want to hear from.
Exactly.
Okay. Anything else to add, Lauren?
Nope.
All right. Julie, same three questions.
So, I have been reading the Outlander series. I'm on book
Yay!
One. I'm on book one. I have Sarah, obviously, was my influence there. Thank you very much. It's starting to get real, so I'm a little concerned because I'm sure all of you have a tendency to dive in and not come up for air, so I'm starting to get to that point on that, but I'm pretty excited. So before that, I read a little tearjerker called After You. I don't know if you guys read the kind of chick-lit kind of stuff. I love some chick-lit.
It depends. I like the funnier clit.
Yeah. So I read that. I can't remember what I read before that, but I read A Man Called Ove. Sarah, did you read Ove?
No.
I thought I gave that one to you. Fantastic. It's about this really bitter old man who's kind of OCD, but he's the most glorious character. I'm so in love with him.
Great.
I would strongly recommend that one for sure. It's a Swedish writer, Frederick Backman. And you know, I love me Swedes, so it was a great book. It was actually a debut novel for this guy, which was really interesting. So
I'll have to check it out.
And then suggestions for next, I will say this. So I am not a horror person.
Ooh.
However, yeah, I know. So I'm like a child. I get scared of the dark at night. Not literally, but kind of. So if we read Stephen King,
kind of literally.
Yeah, kind of literally. I've put furniture in front of the bedroom door one time because I thought I heard something.
That's
that was
great.
Before I had kids, so now I can't do that.
That means but you're doing it right.
Yeah, I'm okay with
so
this.
You wouldn't lock the kids out of your room.
Right, exactly. But so if we go with Stephen King for the next, I'm better with something that definitely could not happen, like a murderous clown, like the movie, you know, like Saw thing, like really creepy people coming to get you in your home or whatever, like depraved people torturing you. I'm not down with that.
I'd say you'd be good with It or Salem's Lot then.
Okay.
Because he's more like, it seems like his early stuff, a lot of his early stuff, with maybe the exception of Carrie, is a lot more natural.
Salem's Lot's the best book ever written.
Rick Wolfington just timed in with Salem's Lot is the best book ever written.
Oh, we have input from Rick.
It is, that is one of my favorites, Stephen King.
I disagree,
ever.
But not by much.
Okay,
so I'm going to ask the same question of Sarah.
So, I would be okay with reading Salem's Lot. I think Lauren and I were talking about that a while ago, and I have... The only Stephen King I've read was It and Duma Key, and I tried to read the Gunslinger series. It was not for me.
Somnia.
Yeah, I was not successful there either. Don't feel bad.
Stephen King usually isn't my cup of tea.
Well, that's all right. What do you like?
So what I have been reading, I'm reading Brooklyn, which is the movie that came out recently. So far, so good there. I just started it. I recently read, it was the Kindle free title, The Queen's Poisoner, which was a fantasy book. It was the first book in a series by Jeff Wheeler. I really enjoyed it, especially for a free book, because sometimes those Kindle freebies are not so great.
That's why they're free.
Right. There's a reason they're free. There's a reason you have self-published. I'm still willing to give you a go, but there's a reason you've self-published. I'm looking at my Goodreads queue. The most recent that I read was The Art of Racing in the Rain, which you gave to me, Julie. It was so good. And it was a dog story. I'm not really into dog stories usually, but that was a fantastic book.
I'm so glad you liked it.
I know, I loved it. I super loved it. I am also reading to Glenn, who's 6, almost 7, Sideways Stories from Wadeside School, which was one of my favorite books from when I was in the 7 to 10 year old range, maybe older. I don't really remember. It's really funny and cute. And then also sort of, wow, they say the word hate and stupid a lot in here, which are words that we usually try not to use with our 6-year-old. But it's a good teaching book, and it's definitely made me laugh out loud a couple of times, so that's fun. And he is rabidly demanding the next chapter, which I love. So that's what I've been reading. I reviewed I'm Up for Anything. Lauren and I also talked about having Russ read Janet Ivanovich, One for the Money.
Yes! I love Stephanie Plum. I would love to revisit her.
How does that compare to Gone Girl?
It's more whimsical and Jersey.
Okay.
And mystery, right?
I have not read... I bet you I read One for the Money like 10 years ago. I would love to read it again. I love some Janet Ivanovich.
Yeah.
Because it's hilarious.
I would love to reread some Stephanie Plum. I'm down.
So my final thought is, my vague idea for this podcast is that it would be really funny to have Russ read a bunch of chick lit and then discuss it with girls.
You did mention that. You did mention that.
That's funny.
Whether it's the three of us or other females, I think that would be hilarious, especially for anyone that knows Russ.
If we do that, can we work some Jen Lancaster in there?
We can try. I failed hard when I tried to read Jen Lancaster, but I will give it another whirl.
Totally.
Jen is my hero.
So, for me, the things that I've been going on lately, I have been rereading, of course, The Passage and The 12, which are Justin Cronin's first two in The Passage trilogy. Series City of Mirrors will be coming out very shortly. I'm very excited about that. Lauren, you'd be interested to know that It was my favorite book of all time until I read The Passage. The Passage is my favorite.
I might have to check that out then.
But that being said, the other stuff I got going on, really, I'm mostly excited about Disney has now purchased the rights and made plans to make Chronicles of Prydain into a whole series, live-action movies. That is one of my very favorite book series of all time. And I've said this before, I'm going to say it again, that a lot of people criticize J.K. Rowling for having taken so much from Tolkien and just turned it into her own creation. I'm going to have to disagree with you there. J.K. Rowling stole heavily from Lloyd Alexander. Now, I'm not going to deny that Lloyd Alexander, of course, also stole from Tolkien. So, and I'll also say that all three series are absolutely terrific. But if you really look at it, the character of Hermione Granger is a carbon copy of Princess Ailanwy, and Lord Voldemort's brilliant plan for immortality was already taken care of by Lord Morda from Tarn Wanderer. Either way, when those movies come out, they're going to be incredible. It's one of my very favorite series of all time. I'm reading to my son right now, a classic, perfect, quintessential Bildungsroman. And obviously, it's not going to have the same depth that you're going to get out of A Song of Ice and Fire, but at the same time, it is something that you can read to a six-year-old. Really enjoy it. Looking forward to those movies.
So those are the things I'm really excited about. Next book, I really don't care. I'd love to do any of those Stephen Kings. If you guys want to do It or Salem's Lot or Duma Key or Lisi's Story, I'd be happy to do any of those. But then if you guys have a totally off-the-wall recommendation, I never thought in my life I never would have picked up All the Light We Cannot See. And even though I didn't absolutely thoroughly love it, I did enjoy it very much. I'm glad to have read it. So with that, I really appreciate everybody being on in this podcast for today. Thank you very much, and have a great evening.
Good night.
Good night.
Good night. Good night. Thanks, guys.